Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome to Vashon 250 and Episode 22, the Staten Island Peace Conference. Every war has meetings about peace, and this one was held on September 11th, 1776. It was an unsuccessful attempt to negotiate peace between British officials and American delegates during the American Revolutionary War. The Staten Island Peace Conference took place shortly after the British captured Long Island and just months after the American Declaration of Independence. The conference aimed to explore a diplomatic solution to the escalating conflict between Great Britain and its rebellious colonies. British Lord Howe and Continental Congress Representative Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Edward Rutledge met to discuss a possible settlement of the emerging American Revolution. The three-hour conference found no agreement, and the British resumed their campaign to capture New York City. The conference, although not successful, demonstrated the hopes of both sides that the rebellion could be settled and the American colonies would continue to be part of the British Empire. The conference remains a notable episode in the American Revolutionary War, symbolizing the intractable differences between the American quest for independence and the British desire to maintain their empire. It highlighted the complexities of diplomacy during a time of war and the challenges faced in seeking a peaceful resolution. Similar efforts to resolve conflicts in their early stages have occurred frequently in American history and are part of the current conflicts in which we are engaged. So, Bruce, let's look at that. Over the last 250 years, the Staten Island Peace Conference sort of, set the tone, and we've seen attempts echoed to find a peaceful end to conflicts. You want to walk through some of what those might be?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and it's good to go back and sort of remind ourselves of what was going on at the time of the Staten Island Peace Conference. I mean, most people have never heard of it, you know, never even knew that there were these attempts to resolve the conflict before it developed into a full-blown war, even though by this time, you know, the war was going on in pretty serious terms. But the idea was that, you know, you had two intractable positions. One, Great Britain, that did not want the colonies to be independent of their empire structure. And so Lord Howe comes into this meeting, you know, not really expecting much, and came into it with that kind of imperious British, you know, admiral sort of attitude. I mean, he'd been used to ordering men around on ships for most of his life, and so he was not really prepared to meet Benjamin Franklin and John Adams in particular, you know, who were two of the revolutionary leaders who were in their own sense, you know, sort of you know, imperious in their own particular ways. And so this peace conference was really set up for failure before it even began. You know, Franklin, Adams, Rutledge, they were sent by the Continental Congress, although they had no authority to really negotiate for the Congress. And so again, from the American side, who had just declared independence, you know, and signed, you know, basically a treasonous document, there's not a whole lot of sense of there would be a resolution to this. And so, you know, the Staten Island Peace Conference, like many initial peace conferences, was really set up for failure. It was not set up to resolve this conflict. But I think for us, it's important to remember that both sides did not want to have a full-blown war. You know, if Britain had said, go your way, with our blessing, you know, pay us taxes, pay us, you know, import duties, pay us whatever, you know, Britain probably would have walked away happy. You know, if Britain had said to the Americans, go ahead, be independent, but be part of what ultimately most British colonies did become, part of a commonwealth, you know, in which they have independence, but also have ties to the quote unquote mother country, the Americans probably would have said yes. So the differences were small, but they were intractable. And so conferences like this are really set up more for show than for a real outcome. And that's what we see in a lot of American peace efforts. As wars develop from the 19th into the 20th and then to 21st century. So, you know, a good example are the Barbary Wars. You know, other than the halls of Montezuma and the shores of Tripoli.
And a good song Marine that goes with it.
Yeah, and the Marine Corps hymn. People don't know that we fought a war against the sort of Barbary Coast pirates in the early 1800s, and actually two wars. The second war in 1850 was only 3 days long, but and settled relatively quickly. But the first war went on from 1801 to 1806, a five-year conflict, basically trying to prevent the Barbary pirates or the Barbary states along the North African coast, you know, from raiding American shipping in the Mediterranean. And what happened during that war was many meetings between American representatives and the Deys, or the sort of the rulers of these North African kingdoms, to try and find resolutions, you know, to pay ransoms, to pay duties, to, you know, find a way to keep American shipping free. So, you know, very early on, this is within 10 years of the United States becoming a nation, we're involved in a war that we try and resolve unsuccessfully until we finally reach an agreement to pay the rulers to keep American shipping free. Sounds a little bit like the Straits of Hormuz.
Just a little bit.
We'll come back to that in a bit.
As just an aside, for all of you listening, this has been an interesting process for all of us involved. And I urge you to read up on Ben Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, those three in particular. They are really smart guys, and they certainly have their faults, but they're really interesting to read about, especially Franklin. He's just a fascinating guy. So that's just an aside to this. So there were really smart people coming to the table with the British Admiral, who also was smart. He wouldn't be an admiral if he was stupid. So there were bright people here, but they just couldn't, you know, they couldn't get past dessert.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, I'm always struck by John F. Kennedy's remark. Kennedy's having a dinner for all the Nobel Prize winners, American Nobel Prize winners in the White House. This is in the early 1960s, shortly after he became president. And he talked about, you know, this room being filled with all these very luminary sort of intellects. And he said, you know, this is probably the greatest gathering of intellects in this White House, except for when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. So it's that concept of Jefferson was a remarkable intellect, as was Franklin, as was Adams, and many of the early colonial leaders. And they were well steeped in the literature of the Enlightenment. And that's where those sort of, you know, we the people and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those phrases from the Declaration of the Constitution all come out of John Locke's work and the work of the Enlightenment. You also have a similar kind of thing going on with this sort of trying to negotiate a peace or trying to negotiate the terms of a war before it gets going. Or even doing it with the Mexican-American War. You know, the Mexican-American War was basically over Texas becoming part of the Union. And of course, Mexico had never really given up on their claim to Texas. And for the Americans, the Wilmot Proviso, which was never passed by Congress but was seriously debated, was an attempt to prevent new states like Texas from becoming slave states and to try and keep that balance between free states and slave states. And so, you know, the negotiations that went on with Mexico involved not only just the conflict itself, but what would Texas be? I mean, Texas at the point, that point was an independent republic, which most Texans never let us forget.
No, we don't.
and yet it was also a slave state. And so the conflict is all wrapped up in these issues of race and territory and ownership. You know, the Civil War itself, I mean, most people think of the American Civil War ending in April 1865 with the surrender of Lee to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse. Well, yes, that sort of ended the major part of the war, but the war did not officially end until August of 1866. You know, it's almost a year and a half later. Conflicts continued into on the fringes of the Civil War. And individual districts, individual armies did not surrender at the same time that Lee surrendered. And so you had this sort of moving target of trying to negotiate endings of the war with each sort of affront, with each sort of area where conflict was occurring. You know, the Spanish-American War is another great example in the sense that, you know, the United States was this new emerging world power at the time. Spain was sort of, you know, an established European power that was on decline, not in their eyes, but in the eyes of the rest of the world. And so the Americans win very substantial victories very early on in the war. And it's apparent that Spain is going to lose this war. But we signed peace protocols in 1898, and it's almost a year before a final treaty is sort of negotiated. So this idea that, you know, meeting like the Staten Island Peace Conference could have led to some kind of agreement to end the Revolutionary War, but the conference itself was not going to do that. You know, it would have taken much, much more to do that.
Well, and as we live it here in 2026, we sometimes lose thought of the fact that communication took forever.
Right.
They didn't have Facebook. They didn't have the telephone. They didn't have all the stuff we have today, which arguably doesn't always work well either.
No.
But that would speak to part of the reason it takes darn long.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the classic example is that's the War of 1812. You know, the Battle of New Orleans, you know, Andrew Jackson, that occurred almost 3 months after the war ended, mm-hmm. after a treaty was signed, but word had not gotten back to the British invading forces who were invading Louisiana and trying to take New Orleans, or to Jackson, who was defending it. So you have this major conflict that after the war's over. You know, so there are some benefits of faster, more modern communications, but they don't always.
They don't always work.
Yeah, they don't always work, and they don't always come to the results that you would hope. You know, another example is sort of during World War II is very early on with the Atlantic Charter. You know, Churchill and Roosevelt setting up this idea that there would be cooperative agreements, defense agreements, and economic agreements during and after the war that essentially lead to the formation of the United Nations after the war, the development of the United Nations Charter, and to the Declaration of Human Rights. So Roosevelt, very early on in the war, articulates what he calls the four freedoms, you know, freedom from want, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and freedom to vote, which become the heart of the Atlantic Charter and the heart of the UN. But, you know, Roosevelt's articulating that in 1939, 1940, and it's not until 1946, 47 that you get the UN Charter, and you get the Charter of Human Rights. So these things don't happen overnight.
He was long gone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, another good example is the Korean War. I mean, the Korean War, when North Korea invaded South Korea, I mean, the Americans came in and we rolled them right back up to the border of China. And of course, MacArthur wanted to go in and take on China. You know, Truman said no, and that ended up in a kerfuffle and ultimately the retirement of MacArthur. But what it did is it brought the Chinese in, and then bam, the Americans are pushed all the way back to the very southeast corner of Korea, the Pusan perimeter. And then it's an invasion at Incheon, led by MacArthur, that sort of, you know, flanks the Chinese and North Korean armies, rolls them back to the 38th parallel, and then there's an armistice. But the Korean War is still going on. It's not over. Yeah. There's never been a peace treaty. So when you start thinking about the sweep of American history, you know, in terms of how these kinds of things work, it's easy to talk about peace. It's hard to negotiate peace. And it's hard to negotiate a treaty that actually ends a war.
And just as an aside, sort of a humorous aside, the television show MASH about the Korean War actually lasted longer than the war itself.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So those are some examples from the sweep of American history. And there's a lot of others, of course. But in terms of current events, you know, what we've seen in the last decade since 2016 is we've got a number of examples of sort of what I would call, you know, attempts to create peace that just don't work. You know, the Afghan war, the longest war in American history. I mean, it starts in 2001, doesn't really end until 2021. And there's negotiations in 2020, 2021 between the United States representatives and the Taliban, but they didn't include the Afghan government. And so you get this peace agreement that you have two of the three parties engaged in it have agreed, but the third party, the Afghan government itself, did not agree. And so when the terms of the agreement start to be implemented, it just falls. And you have this disastrous sort of American exit from Afghanistan because the Taliban didn't have to deal with the Afghan government as a third party. The Afghan government sort of abdicated and fled, and the Taliban sort of rolled in, and it was a disaster. So in the best of times.
Yeah. And if we look back further when Russia tried to take Afghanistan, they had the same experience.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And the parallels there, and Truman will know about this. I mean, the kinds of things the Soviets were trying to do in Afghanistan that we were trying to do in Afghanistan were the same kinds of things we were trying to do in Vietnam. And they didn't work then. They didn't work for the Russians. They didn't work for us. And it's sort of like, when are we going to learn those lessons, you know? Low tech beats high tech every time. You know, it's just sort of like, wait a minute. You know, there's a couple other examples going on right now. The Ukraine war, you know, which has been a relatively extended war if you go back to 2014 when Crimea is annexed by Russia. And there's no resistance to that other than sort of diplomatic and sanctions and that kind of thing. Yeah. But what happens then in 2022, Russia invades to try and take over the Donbass region of Ukraine. And out of that in 2014 and 2015, you get the Minsk agreements, which are agreements to begin to work toward a peace in Ukraine. And here we are in 2026, and we're no closer than we were in 2014 when it started, and so you go back to the Staten Island peace agreement, and that sort of conference to try and resolve the American Revolution, and you bring it up to 2025, 2026, with the meetings that have been going on, you know, between Ukraine and Russia, and you see it's the same issue. It's very, very difficult to negotiate a peace settlement in the midst of a war.
So let's, in our remaining minutes, let's look at our own Vashon and how the Staten Island Peace Conference might have relevance here.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to draw direct parallels with the peace conference in Vashon because, you know, Vashon's really never had wars other than between neighbors and sometimes between neighborhoods and occasionally between Maury Island and Vashon Island. So some of the issues on Vashon have centered around what was known often as the Mason-Dixon line. And people often ask me, well, what was the Mason-Dixon line? Because you don't hear much about it these days. But it's really a line that runs across the island, essentially where Cemetery Road is. And that line, it's fascinating. That line sort of distinguishes a lot of differences between the north part and the south part of Vashon. And of course, all of Maury Island is in that south part. What you get along that Mason-Dixon line is not only a cultural divide, because that was the old divide between school districts on the island. So all of the school districts to the north ultimately combined into the Vashon School District. All of the school districts to the south ultimately combined into the Burton School District. And then ultimately, you know, they all combine into one Vashon school district in the 1940s. You know, there's a Burton High School, there's a Vashon High School, and the football games, the sports competitions were fierce. You know, all the stores in Docton and Burton and Vashon would close for the football games. There'd be fisticuffs. Is what it was called in the newspaper of the time. You know, young guys and, you know, sort of beating each other up because one was from Vashon, the other was from Burton, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, so there was this sort of cultural divide there. And of course, as Seattle emerged in the 1920s and 30s as a dominant city and the island began to focus more towards Seattle, the folks on the south end who were focused toward Tacoma became much less satisfied with the level of ferry service with the roads. I mean, all the construction of new roads was on the north part of the island for the most part. The paving of roads was on the north part of the island, not on the south part of the island. So there's this cultural divide. There's this political divide facing toward Seattle, facing toward Tacoma. But there's also a sort of ecological divide along that line. I've talked to Bianca Perla and Maria Mettler from the Vashon Nature Center a number of times just about the amount of rainfall that occurs south of there is of the Mason-Dixon line is much less than the rain that occurs north of the Mason-Dixon line. The types of soils begin to change right about there. That Cemetery Road, Mason-Dixon line is the dividing line between the Judd Creek watershed, which is the largest watershed that flows to the south on the island, and Shingle Creek watershed, which is the watershed that flows north on the island. And so there's this sort of a whole set of things that go together to help define this Mason-Dixon line that go beyond just the political, go beyond just the social, that go into the ecological, that go into the nature of the farms on the north side of the island versus the south side of the island. And so it becomes this significant dividing point. And in 1953, I mean, when the new Judd Creek Bridge is opened, it becomes this ceremonial joining of the island. There's actually been four bridges over Judd Creek since the first bridge which was built, which was a simple log float bridge across Judd Creek, so you could get from north to south, from sort of the north end of Quartermaster Harbor down to Burton without having to go all the way up over the hill. And that was very quickly replaced in 1891 by a trestle bridge. You know, if you've seen old cowboy movies, you've seen these sort of trains right driving across these trestle bridges that feel like they're miles in the sky, you know. So that was the original Judd Creek Bridge. And then it was replaced in 1929 by a little more substantial bridge. And then in 1953 by the present bridge. And the present bridge used a very innovative hollow concrete cellular box construction technique that was later used, that was originally used on the Mercer Island Bridge. And the engineer who developed that technique, you know, has won many architectural awards. And the Judd Creek Bridge is actually designated as a King County landmark because of this special kind of construction. But when the bridge opened in 1953, they had this large ceremony. And what they did is they strung across the bridge a large sort of cable that was filled with bananas and snowballs. Bananas for the banana belt of the South End. You know, you think of Gold Beach, which wasn't there at that point, but you think of the climate at Gold Beach, or you think about the South End of Maury and the South End of Vashon. I mean, they really are a banana belt. So they had bunches of bananas, and then they had snowballs, you know, alternating across this to represent the north end of the island. And the ceremonial cutting of this sort of cable across the bridge was designed to unite the north and the south ends of the island. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, you go back to this, you know, Staten Island Peace Conference, and how do you sort of resolve conflicts on an island like Vashon? And because we don't have open warfare conflicts, what we have are these symbolic kind of conflicts. But then you also see things similar to that with the bridge, you know, the bridge to Seattle, the floating bridge. In the 1950s and 60s, you know, 70-80% of the islanders were in favor of it. By the 1990s, that totally flips on its head, where you have all these people opposing it. And how many times have islanders met with the ferry system to try and resolve ferry conflicts? I mean, so, yeah, we don't have peace conferences on Vashon, but we do have these attempts to resolve conflicts or to get recognition. And then, of course, we could always talk about the many times Vashon has tried to break away from King County, and we'll talk more about that when we talk about the American Revolution, and we talk about sort of other kinds of conflicts.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see if we need a peace conference while the bridge is closed for resurfacing here in the next several weeks.
That's right. Yes.
And also, do we need a peace conference with the county's initiative to put into place state and federal law about septic around the waterfront? That was there was a meeting with that a few days ago. Excuse me. And I don't think the county officials expected as many people to turn out. And one of the gentlemen said to me, "We didn't expect this." And I said, "You're dealing with money, property, and septic. Everybody's going to show up." And it'll be interesting to see where that all shakes out and whether we need a peace conference for that. So, good. Well, that is the Staten Island Peace Conference, episode 22. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next time to talk about Nathan Hale, Grand Patriot of America. Thanks for joining us. See you next time. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.